This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 94 of the DTV Digest, bringing you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media instead. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me, as usual, is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
So, this episode, there's a huge, huge release on Netflix. One of two, actually. The first one, I suppose, is the Irishman by Martin Scorsese. I think that was a huge coup for Netflix. But the one we're going to be looking at is Michael Bay's Six Underground, which fits more into the DTV sort of action bracket that we like to cover. Starring Ryan Reynolds. We'll get onto it in a minute. Also this week we have our a short shot, which is Pizza Time, starring Eric Jacobus. Yeah, there we go. And our DTV throwback is another one which totally passed me by back in the day. It is Metal Beast, and we'll be getting onto that shortly. So, our feature review this week is Six Underground, directed by Michael Bay. Nice to see him get away from the Transformers nonsense for once, but unfortunately he seems to have brought all his tricks and toy box along with him for this particular outing. So, Ryan Reynolds is a billionaire vigilante, basically. Who's done a bit of special ops work in the past, and has faked his own death and become what he describes as a ghost, along with five people that he's hired to do the same, each known only by their number. And we jump straight into a massive showcase of action and pyrotechnics and cars flipping and all sorts somewhere in Italy, without much of a clue as to what the fuck is going on. It eventually kind of settles down, but the style here is flash, flash, flash. Rich, your thoughts?
I loved it.
Seriously?
Yeah, okay. It's like I got a feeling from that intro there that you weren't enamored with it, and I think I saw a post where you were saying about the editing giving you a bit of a headache.
Well, not necessarily a headache. I mean, that was Tom Jolliffe's take
right.
on it. He, and a few people have chimed in now saying, you know, they got like 10 minutes into the film and had to turn it off.
Yeah.
I did actually love the whole film.
Yeah.
I kind of enjoyed it, but in a very sort of begrudging kind of way. The editing of this thing, if you try and count the number of seconds any time the camera settles on a particular shot, I think the maximum is about 4 seconds. You know, I was literally counting that one, two, no, it's gone. Right, one, two, no, it's gone. One, two, three, no, it's gone. Change the angle, change shot or whatever. Even quiet, sort of introspective talky bits have this editing all the way through. It must have taken ages to edit this film.
Yeah.
You know, absolute donkeys. And in fact, it took three people to edit this film.
Well, this film is full of his trademarks, and that is one of them. And for me, that really worked, because the whole film is what you found was like difficult. You found difficult to sort of digest. I just found it like relentless pace that was just sort of keeping your adrenaline going, because it was just so intense all the time. And for me, that really worked. I'm not a big fan of most of his films, but this took me back to the best, back to The Rock and Armageddon. And a few years after that, we had The Island, which for me was the last one I really loved. Although I think it was Transformers Dark of the Moon. Although it was bad and really overlong, for some reason, I remember really going with that, really enjoying that film. Age of Extinction was really bad, and was there another one after that, or is that? Oh no, we had The Last Night as well.
The Last Night, yeah. They're all bad.
So, They're pretty bad. Because of that, mm-hmm. I've only seen since The Island, I've seen the Transformers ones and this.
Right.
And I haven't seen 13 Hours or Pain and Gain. But now I feel like renewed and like I want to give those films a chance because I really engaged with Michael Bay's style in those films and taking me back and thinking when I really did enjoy those car chases he did in like The Rock and that, which is basically what you get here. I mean, that opening sequence, I just couldn't believe it. That car chase was like 15 going on 20 minutes.
About 20 minutes, long. The whole thing, yeah.
There was an aspect of it I was uncomfortable with, which was the collateral damage of innocent bystanders getting hit by the heroes because of the heroes. And he does kind of revel in that because there's this whole thing of actually, well, I've got CGI. I can actually show people
getting
knocked all over the place and blood and that. So this is kind of let off. It's unrestrained, you know. This is full on sweary, shooty blood, you know, kind of adults only kind of material, which is refreshing again after Transformers stuff, which is kind of been toned down, but not really suitable for kids.
This is this is higher than a PG-13, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're on proper. I mean, this is from the writers of Deadpool, and we're in proper Deadpool kind of territory here.
Yeah. I mean, what does help this film a lot is the presence of Ryan Reynolds, who does bring that sort of shouty, cheeky charm, you know. And he's really good in it, you know.
Yeah.
There are some great moments where, you know, when he sort of revels in the chaos of it, basically, you know.
Yeah, the whole plot is he's basically Bruce Wayne. Hmm. Assembling the Justice League, or he's assembled the Justice League and he's got to go get a new member so that the new member can be like the representative of the audience and he can explain to everyone how it's working, and then they go on the Mission Impossible. So, you know, there's nothing original here. It's all stuff we've seen a million times before. It's just like a different kind of package. But, you know, for that, you know, I didn't have a problem with it. It was like, you know, when they adapted the A-Team.
Yeah.
And this is like, it's a movie that feels like it was based on a TV show. It's got a concept. It's got an idea. Because as with Mission Impossible, it's a team dynamic and they're going on missions. And we get one random mission, which is to take out this dictator in this particular story. But it could easily roll on into sequels and series or whatever they wanted.
Yeah, there is a little sort of personal vendetta here. You know, the fact that, you know, in his sort of Bruce Wayne mode, he was looking to, you know, set up some sort of charity or something, or you know, present himself as a philanthropic sort of, you know, benefactor, and ends up getting caught in the middle of this gas attack that this guy's doing. You know, sort of very, very much shades of Syria going on with this, I think it's a made-up country of
Kyrgyzstan.
Basically. The baddie's really good in this, you know, really sort of hissably evil. Gets a good comeuppance at the end. The whole thing on the yacht is really well done. You know, the rescue of the brother is really well done, and the car chase is really well done. You know, in terms of, as you say, you know, getting the adrenaline going and everything. But it's just that editing. I was like, oh my god, it was going out of its way to sort of try and hide what was actually being shown to a certain degree.
The fight scenes, for example, they were a bit over-edited. I would definitely say I couldn't follow. I mean, there wasn't a lot of one-on-one martial arts or anything in it. It was mostly shooting.
Yeah, and the bits that were like done by Ryan Reynolds, you know, which was actually pretty cool. But then, you know, the team that he's assembled, is quite random, you know.
Yeah, they don't really delve too much into the specifics of how this is all working. You know, we never really learn much about the motivations or who the characters are, where they come from very much, or what, how it actually works. It's just kind of a, yeah, this is the thing, and we're going to go and do a thing. It's like, don't think about it too much. Yeah. Just enjoy it.
Exactly. So he's got an ex-CIA sort of spy. He's got a medic, a guy who does parkour really well, a so-called assassin, and a fast driver. That's his team that he's put together. And it's like, why? Why have you chosen these people?
How did he find them? And so, yeah, we just don't know. It's like a Bruce Wayne-y kind of thing. But the other thing was, it's funny because it's from Netflix, because it also reminded me of Polar earlier in the year, which we covered, which did basically the same thing in a different way. It was that whole kind of Smoking Aces character intro,
title card, all that sort of thing. Yeah, number one, you know, the billionaire. Number two, whoever it was, the spy or whatever.
In media res, the intro and sort of going back.
Yeah.
I don't know if Ola did that, but that's another sort of quite common. You know, it's loads of tricks. Like, every trick in the book is pretty much in here. But, you know, I like, you know, Bay's visuals and the great locations that he finds. The product placement is quite fun. What's even great is because on Netflix it actually even comes up saying, there's product placement in this. You're like, no surprises there. LaVara coffee truck turns up.
Well, yeah, and they're a bit, you know, even there's a scene of him sitting at a cafe having a cup of coffee, you know, with the Lavazza sort of logo on it, you know, and there's absolutely no reason for that scene to be there. And, but the product placement, it goes so far as, like, when you've got, like, refugees running for cover and they're wearing, like, Jeep t-shirts and things like this, it's like, okay, you know, there's just so much of it.
It's kind of that whole Diet Coke advert aesthetic thing that he's always done, you know, like we're in Armageddon, you know, they would show all these places around the world and all the sensitive shots and people in suffering and stuff.
It's quite funny, you know. I mentioned to you that I was watching Dark Phoenix, the last X-Men film, during the week, and the one thing it reminded me of was like it was trying to ape that style of Michael Bay. It was, you know, trying to get all those establishing shots of, like, people sort of watching the X-Men on their missions, you know. Oh, I hope the X-Men make it. Oh, you know, sort of people in Delhi or somewhere like that. Sort of like, oh, we must watch, you know, this. it's awful. But
what's worse is when you try and watch one of these films, like when I was watching The Last Night, and not only have you got that fast-paced editing style, but Sky decided to show it in a version that changed aspect ratio constantly.
Yeah.
Like, 1 minute it's full screen, next minute, when I say full screen, I mean like 16:9. So 1 minute it's like full, fills up the screen, then it's widescreen, then it's back again. it's like, what on earth were they doing? I don't know what they were thinking there. I don't understand why they didn't just show it in widescreen. I mean, everyone watches, you know, CinemaScope kind of aspect ratios and that one.
It's not the 90s anymore, you know. We know how films are supposed to look.
Yeah. And luckily in this, being on Netflix, it was, you know, it was a really easy, you know, clear vision in that sense. Now, for me, I mean, this must be the biggest budget Netflix movie yet. I mean, I don't think this is one... Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think this is one they actually funded rather than bought.
Yes, that's right. This has got to be a Netflix film right from the off. Same with The Irishman, you know, that they gave Scorsese the budget for that one. You know, and total artistic freedom, I guess.
Except in the case of Scorsese, he managed to wangle a cinema release as well, so it wasn't basically a DTV movie. And in this case, Michael Bay's not getting this on a cinema screen, which I think is sad because I think there's some really good stuff that would have looked great on a cinema screen. All the stuff in Florence.
You know how when you go to the cinema and they've got the adverts and the trailers and things on, and it's kind of a way to get your eyes and ears adjusted to the, you know, the amount of information coming from the screen into your eyes. You'd have to watch a hell of a lot of adverts before you sat down to watch this, you know, to get the right sort of like frame of mind for it. But when it eventually settled down, you know, once it's kind of established itself as to who and what everything was going on, it is enjoyable. I didn't regret watching it, that's for sure. But I was, you know, annoyed and amazed by the amount of edits and you know, the amount of quick change between shots. It was just, like, stupid and totally unnecessary. Because they had to have filmed, like, the proper stuff. Yeah. And then edited it down into these choppy little bits.
Oh, of course. He must have, you know. He must have had a ridiculous amount of footage.
Yeah. So, you know, it's no real excuse for it.
Have you seen 13 Hours in Pain and Gain?
I have, actually.
And do they have the same thing going on, or are they a bit more restrained?
I didn't... Well, with 13 Hours, for example, I certainly didn't notice the edit. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed 13 Hours. I think that is a very good film. Pain and Gain, again, I'm not sure. I can't remember about the sort of the editing, but it is a weird story. It is funny at times, and it is worth seeing just to see Dwayne Johnson playing this coked up dude, you know, just totally high on coke.
Because this is another story which is basically they're the heroes, but actually they're not very nice
That's
people.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
A bit like a Rise of the Foot Soldier or a gangster movie or anything, you know, like that. They're pretty much idiots.
Yeah, they are. These are sort of like
Wolf of Wall Street. That's the other one I was trying to think of.
Yeah. So Pain and Gain are these sort of bodybuilders who kidnap their boss. I think it is. In order to sort of extort money, but yeah, as you can imagine, it goes horribly wrong. But there, yeah, but okay, so you know, kudos to Netflix for funding this and giving Michael Bay free reign to do what the fuck he wants, basically. And kudos to Michael Bay for getting Ryan Reynolds to do it, because he does sort of anchor this quite well. And, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll get a 7 Underground or, you know, 8 Underground in the future. So,
well, one thing I was wondering was, obviously, as soon as I heard about this movie, I've had the Sneaker Pimps going around in my head.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, there's no sign of that song in the film.
No, that's a real missed opportunity, isn't it? And there's plenty of songs on the soundtrack as well.
Yeah.
It's not as if they're skimpy. Yeah. Weird.
So I'm thinking, is Six Underground some sort of common term that's used in different contexts? Because the song, you know, is the only thing that I've ever encountered that's called Six Underground. So I just presumed the title was taken from the song, which clearly isn't the case.
Absolutely.
But it just seems like it should have been. I don't know. That was really difficult for me to get. I'm still trying to figure out why that is, but. They came up with this. Maybe they came up with the title. They thought, oh, it's good for the song, but actually Michael Bay didn't like the song, so he decided to use different music instead.
How do you score this one? Okay. Yeah, it's got to be a 7.
Yeah, I'm going to go in at 8 because I actually think I will rewatch this.
Oh, I am going to rewatch it, that's for sure. Because
unlike some.
G wants to see it, but yeah. And I probably will enjoy it the second time round, you know, even more.
Another one that made me think of was The Losers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Jeff Dean Morgan and Zaldana, yeah.
So that was a similar kind of thing, wasn't it, if I recall correctly?
It was, yeah. That and, you know, as you mentioned, the A-Team and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think with The Losers one, The Losers are quite similar to the A-Team in that sort of one of their members sort of betrays them and sets them up at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, then after sort of come back from the dead, as it were, or, you know, escape prison to come out. Yeah, I quite enjoyed that one. But that's one of the ones, it was a thing back in the sort of early 2000s when computers were still relatively new, you know. And whenever you had someone doing a bit of hacking and stuff, you know, they'd be typing away and then they'd be narrating what they're doing at the same time. Like, and then sort of like hitting the keys like really hard at the same time. So like, I'm now opening the gateway now. Click. You know, that sort of thing. Just so it makes it really dramatic, you know, when all you're doing is like, yeah, you're just punching a bit of code, mate. You know, get on with it. But there you go. So yes, 6 Underground.
You're giving it 7.
7.
I'm giving it 8.
Great. Excuse me while I die.
You're gonna have a cough.
I'm gonna have a cough. Okay, it's there. It's on Netflix. Everyone's talking about it. If you haven't seen it yet, watch it over Christmas. You won't be disappointed. It's, you know, not exactly family friendly. There's a couple of sort of not exactly gratuitous sex scenes in it. Lots of headshots and all that sort of stuff going on, bit of blood. So, you know, approach with caution. It's not a family film is what we're trying to say here, guys.
Mike, you said watch it over Christmas. This probably won't go out until New Year.
Oh, well, never mind. Our short shot this week is Pizza Time. In this one, Ben Worley plays a pizza delivery guy working for a pizza shop which prides itself on never being late with its pizzas. It's got a whole hall of fame in its corridor of all the people who've had perfect records. His latest delivery, though, goes awry when nobody answers the door. He finds the back door open, goes inside, and finds his customer being murdered by a hitman. And things only get worse from there. Rich, over to you.
This was released a few weeks ago, probably, I think, so it came out in late November, I think, on the Film Riot channel. It's directed by Ryan Polly, written by Ryan Polly as well, and co-stars Eric Jacobus, who's the main reason we were excited about seeing this, because the trailer popped up in, say, early November, I think. And we'd last seen Jacobus in Blindsided the Game. Yep. So we're very aware of, we'd seen him before in other stuff as well, but we were very aware of, you know, how his great talents, he is in the action stuff. Yeah, his talents. And this isn't his project, but he's a key component to it. So and Film Riot's, the short films they've put out, or, you know, they've distributed, have always been really good. So I had been really looking forward to this, and it didn't disappoint at all. The film is shot really well. It's got a brilliant widescreen aesthetic, great cinematography. Love the heightened reds and stuff, pizza delivery guy's outfit and stuff, and the choreography is great. And yeah, it's a very entertaining film.
It is. I mean, there's not much point sort of talking about the plot here because it's very short. You know, there's some very good sort of gags in it. There's a whole bit where he has a fight in this sort of game room where there's, like, you know, video games. I think one of them's something like Street Fighter or something. And while he's getting beaten up, he's accidentally sort of moving the joysticks around, and, you know, you get sort of commentary from the game. It's quite good. There's a nice sort of Home Alone homage when a Lego airplane gets broken and sort of pieces scattered across the floor and what happens with that. It's one of the sort of high points of the short. It's just really, really well done. You know, sort of very limited dialogue. It's mainly just the two characters, you know, sort of fighting all over the house. Did you see the making of that went with it?
Yes, I did. I watched the 14-minute one, but I believe there's like a 40-minute one.
All right. I saw the one which was linked to it, which is like, as you say, the 14-minute one, which gives a bit more sort of background as to who Ryan Polly is.
And he'd never made an action film before. Okay. He'd always wanted to.
And that's right, yeah.
Did really. I mean, I you would never guess from seeing this that he'd never done an action film before, because I think it just came off so well. And, you know, Eric Jacobus is a big part of that.
Yeah, so Eric, you know, as well as sort of playing the, you know, the hitman in this, he's also the stunt coordinator. So him and Ben Worley, between them, doing all this sort of stuff. It's just really, really good. I mean, we'll put the link on to, you know, the footnotes as we do. It's sitting there on YouTube, just waiting to be discovered. Basically, it, you know. Was it 40 minutes, 15 minutes?
Yeah, it's probably about 13 minutes. It's about 10 minutes plus credits. Yeah, and
exactly. You can watch this in your lunch hour. You know, have a chortle over your sandwich. Definitely check it out. This, as we say, this isn't something that Eric Jacobus has directed himself. This is Ryan's work, but it works really well. There was one interesting thing with the, you know, the making of thing, because they're showing the house that they're sitting up in and all the previs stuff they're doing. And I'm thinking, wow, that looks so different to how the house ends up. You know, the way that it's lit and everything, and how they sort of dressed it. And then you find out at the end, oh, they lost the house like sort of a few days before shooting and had to find somewhere else. It's like, oh, well, that'll explain why it didn't quite quite look the same. But even so, there's a great job. When you see the actual location compared to how they filmed it, it's a huge difference and works really well.
Yeah, the story is quite simple. It's basically a fight short, like one of the films we might see at the Fight Spirit Film Festival. But one of the guys is not a fighter. So that's what makes it a bit more interesting than what you might expect. You might have been watching this and thought, oh, it's going to turn into a full-on martial arts fight scene between both guys. But the pizza guy is just a pizza guy, so he's just running around a bit out of his depth and, just trying to pick up stuff and throw.
Yeah, so he's using his environment as best he can to sort of keep alive, basically. So, yeah.
And then it's kind of one of those shorts which is... there's a punchline. So the film is like a joke. It's all the setup to a payoff to a joke, basically. And I thought that was really nice. I thought that worked out well.
Yeah.
Don't forget to stay tuned during the credits because there is a post-credit scene.
Was there? Shit. I'm rubbish at that sort of thing. So I take it you haven't seen Satanic Panic.
No, not yet. I do want to. I've heard it's very good.
Yeah, it's very good. And that has a similar setup with the pizza person, turning up to the house, demanding to be paid, but end up sort of getting embroiled in sort of the larger story sort of thing. It could easily sort of be sort of hand in hand with that, really.
Just a passing note that the star, the main actor in the film, Ben Whalley, he's the brother of director Seth Whalley, who makes the Red Giant films.
Right.
And he has starred in some of those films as well, which are also well worth the look. So there's like Plot Device and what was the other one? I mean, he has a small appearance in Go Bag, which, Go Bag's one of my favourites, which is well worth seeing. And Spy versus Guy or Spy versus... Yeah, Spy versus Guy.
Yeah.
Old new. There's so many great films that these guys have made. Hugh LeGram, look them up.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So check them out. Ben Whalley actually, I think, did the music for this one as well. The music was great. It's got that
really good synth score.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, check it out.
Absolutely. Our DTV throwback this week is Project Metal Beast from 1995. In this one, an unhinged CIA agent injects himself with werewolf blood that he got from Budapest, then put on ice by his boss, only to be thawed out 20 years later for some cutting research into skin grafting by an unsuspecting team of scientists. So this one, again, Rich, totally passed me by. Back in the day, I hadn't come across this one at all. I must admit, I did enjoy it a lot. There's an interesting sort of amount of cynicism to it, which it doesn't sort of dwell on, but I must admit, was kind of refreshing. Barry Bostwick, who I always remember as Brad from Rocky Horror Show.
Right.
Rocky Horror Picture Show, I should say. Brad and Janet. Playing this sort of very evil, sort of cynical, sort of CIA boss who has no qualms about, killing off people to keep things as secret as possible. There's a bit after the sort of it's kind of like two prologues in this film. You've got the hunt for the werewolf at the beginning, and then you've got the initial attempt to figure out how to use the werewolf blood, which ends up with this guy sort of turning into a werewolf and killing a few people. And there's an interesting scene where Barry Bostwick just turns around to one of the female scientists who at that point you think is going to be one of the leads in the film and says, oh, such and such, we'll show you back to your office. You've got to hand over all your files. And then he sort of, as she wanders off, he turns around to this guy and goes, yeah, when you're finished, just stick a body in the cryo lab afterwards. It's like, oh, that's really, really grim, and then that's the last you hear of her, basically. And then we jump 20 years later and we got a whole new cast of characters, including Kim Delaney as Dr. Anna DiCarlo, who's invented this sort of new synthetic skin which he's hoping to use on sort of cancer victims and things. But along comes Barry Bostwick, who decides that that what she's been developing is perfect for the guy that he's got on ice, who has him defrosted, and starts this skin transplant, which basically makes his skin as hard as metal, hence the title of the film. So your thoughts, Rich?
I was thinking this is better than it had really any right to be. It's kind of, I mean, like you, I've never seen it, although I was familiar with it because I remember seeing the cover art, which is very distinctive when it came out in the UK as Metal Beast on, you know, good old big box VHS tape from New Age Entertainment back in the day. It's now arrived on Prime with the American version of the title, where they've just kind of tacked the
word project. Literally tacked on project.
Tacked it on, yeah. It's really obvious. Yeah. But I thought it was actually surprisingly classy, and has that real old school monster movie feel to it. And I think it's very deliberate. The guy who's directed it.
Alessandro Gattano, yeah.
Yeah, he's only made like 7 films over the course of like 40 years. He started in the mid 70s, so by the time he made this, he'd already been making films for 20 years. So every project, it seems, took a fair amount of time to get off the ground. He mixed around in different genres, but he's a writer and director, so this is like he puts the project together. So this was his thing, and I thought he did a really nice. You'd call it an homage, really, to the Universal monster films, I'd say. The film starts out with the mission to go and get the werewolf's blood, which is all very economical. You know, it's all shot in close-ups. There's not really much of a backgrounds or extras or anything like that. It's all very economically done. There are some helpful information tidbits that come up on screen in a kind of fashion, although it doesn't scroll on the screen. No. But it tells you exactly right. Here's what they're doing. Here's why they're doing it, and here's where they are.
We don't have any establishing shots of Budapest. You just take our word for it. This is where we are.
Yeah.
But it sets it in motion, doesn't it?
It's
economical, but it was actually really well done. You know, when sort of the first guy gets chomped and everything, I thought, yeah, there's a fair amount of blood going on here. You know, they're not cutting corners.
And creature effects. You know, it's a good old man in suit.
Is pretty decent. And of course, they got Kane Hodder as well to dress up in the suit.
Be the Metal Beast, yeah. So we get the first part of the film is that it's in the 1974 or 1970. Is it 74 or 75? 74. And the whole film is a twist on the mad scientist formula. The twist being that they're getting the scientists to do the work. You know, it's like an authority figure instructing the scientist, but he's, to all intents and purposes, both guys, Barry Bostwick and I'm not sure who the main actor was in the first part of the film, whose project this is, they both share the role of the mad scientist in the classical sense. So in one way, it's Frankenstein. You know, it's the Wolf Man, it's the Invisible Man. It's all those things that are going on in there. You know, the guy wants the thing, he wants to discover, make the ultimate super soldier, and he wants to be, you know, the test subject. He's so driven, he's going to inject it into himself, and damn the consequences, kind of thing. Yeah. And then he starts killing people, and then they sort of stop that bit. That stops. We jump forward. You know, the film's already been going on 20 minutes.
At least.
Suddenly, we're jumped forward 20 years. All of a sudden, we're set up in another environment. We're basically in 1950s B movie horror territory now. You know, like basically The Thing from Another World and variations on that. So you've got like the group of scientists in the facility. There's a monster. You know, picking them off one by one. You know, so from that kind of point on, I wasn't as engaged because it became a bit more by the numbers.
Running up and down corridors, basically.
Running up and down corridors, yeah. And I think it was, but still, well done. You know, there's some attention to detail and some nice shots, some nice framing that's going on in there.
Yeah.
In spite of, you know, Barry Bostwick brings some gravitas because, you know, although he's done, you know, fairly shoddy films over the years and, you know, lots of mega force and all that kind of thing. Yeah. He still has this great presence and great authority, and he's essentially Paul Reiser from Aliens.
Yes.
In this, instead of working for Weyland-Yutani, he's working for the government, which is, you know, par for the course with all that kind of. You know, it starts off in the 70s, where, of course, you've got the whole Watergate and all that mistrust of government figures and that. So it kind of settles itself quite well in American, you know, history and the, you know, distrust of authority, you know, like so many other films have done. And that plays out really nicely. And then it works towards the return of the werewolf in the new form of the Metal Beast, which, for me, just seemed like it was just very much a prototype of Jason X.
Yeah, basically.
Right down to Kane Hodder, you know. Kane Hodder was Jason, killed off, cryogenically frozen, whatever, reawakens his face, alien technology gets hold of him, and he becomes a superhuman, indestructible Jason. This was the same, but with a werewolf.
Yeah.
Exactly the same.
There's a couple of funny bits I want to mention.
Yeah, go on.
Towards the end, well, for one thing, they go down into the cellars of the base they're actually at. So they've been working at this place for a long time, but never gone down into this particular cellar. And it is absolutely not only has the Barry Bostwick been keeping his cryogenic specimens frozen down there all this time, but also, you know, there's miles and miles of tunnels and things to run around.
It's very spacious.
Yeah. Now, the main actress, the main character, Anna DiCarlo, ends up getting caught in an explosion and ends up with a metal bar through her foot. Which is a really good-looking effect. And,
yeah.
You know, she has to pull it out and everything. But then she basically ties a tourniquet around it, and suddenly she's able to sprint down corridors again, as if it doesn't affect her. You know, every now and again she'd go, ooh, limp, you know. But yeah, she's literally sprinting down corridors at times.
That's where we kind of get the alien kind of aspect of it. We've got her, but we don't just get her. We've got Musetta Vanda in there as a colleague. So we get two heroines fighting the monster at the end, and including rocket launchers and all sorts. It's great.
Oh, that was the funny scene as well. You know, it's a werewolf movie, so there's various tropes that you have to have. You know, so silver bullets is one, and Barry Bostwick's got in his drawer. He's got a Desert Eagle with a clip full of silver bullets, and then the captain guy, you know, he's got a collection of silver dollars on his desk, so he goes and gathers them all up, and he melts them down into sort of warheads for missiles to be, you know, for a rocket launcher, which I thought was class. You know, it's like, oh no, I'm not fucking around with little silver bullets. You know, this guy's got metal skin. I'm going for a proper, you know, silver tipped rockets at this point, which I thought was, a nice escalation. Now, there's one other little bit I want to mention. It is a sort of blink and you'll miss it kind of thing. When Anna DiCarlo is sneaking around Barry Bostwick's office, she finds a file, because the first time she's there, she sees the box of with the gun and the silver bullets. When she goes back the second time, that's gone. And instead, she finds a big, thick file in there. So she pulls that out and opens it up. And on one page is just a blank piece of paper with the words, "I'm so sorry," and then the name of the director, Alessandro Gaetano, written on it. and that's it. You know, it just says, "I'm so sorry, Alessandro," you know, in big letters. Which I thought was just bizarre.
I didn't get that. What was in that file?
I think it was the
evidence.
Yeah, the not Miller, the butler.
Yeah,
his file and things like that, and the photos from what had happened like 20 years earlier. But yeah, it was just a big sign saying, "I'm so sorry."
I didn't even notice the director's name. That's hilarious. Yeah. This was. It's a bit like with Ticks that we talked about last week. You know, this is a film of a particular time, you know, the low budget film, but, you know, the money's clearly gone on the effect. You know, they've put the money on the practical effects, and they're really great. In this case, it's John Carl Buchler, Buchler is how I'm going to pronounce his name, who's, you know, very well regarded visual effects guy. I believe he died recently, March in 2019.
All right.
He passed away, but he'd done, you know, absolutely tons of stuff, including directing several films. including Ghoulies Go to College, which was a personal favourite growing up, and Friday the 13th, part 7. He worked with Kane Hodder quite a lot all the way through his career. He worked on Hatchet stuff like that. So that this is worth watching, you know, even if you think, oh, I've seen, you know, this sort of thing a load of times before, whatever. I mean, the novelty of a metal werewolf is great fun. The fact that it looks like the Predator is pretty awesome. You know, it's a very good suit. And Kane Hodder's like, you know, a big guy, so he can just sort of sell it more than anyone, you know. But all the other aspects are good in it. You know, there's a good full body explosion in there. Mm-hmm. You know, like you say, there was that effect with the spike. Course, you know, the spike roof, that was amazing. Mm-hmm. It's a trashy but quite stylish, quite classy film that I highly recommend.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want a decent sort of creature feature. From back in the day, you know, 95, so that's, 23 years old? Yeah. 24 years old. And it stands up quite well. So, yeah, check it out. That's Metal Beast, all one word, on Amazon Prime. And that's the end of this week's show, the first one of 2020. We hope you enjoyed it. Hope you're going to check out the films. As we said, Six Underground is on Netflix, Metal Beast is on Amazon Prime, and the Short Shots, Peter Time, will provide a link to the to where you can find it on YouTube. Check them out and let us know what you think. If you want to get in contact with us, or you want to follow on the other bits that we do, like the charts and any coming soons that we come across, you can find us on Twitter as the DTV Digest and on Facebook under the same title. So yeah, check us out and you know, subscribe and all that sort of nonsense. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.